سہنا بھوتو سہنو بھونتو سہ وریم کروابہی تیجسوینابتیتمستو ما ودھشاوہی اوم شانتی شانتی شانتی. Take one, verse 3. Get it for me, okay? Sarvar nidanam jagato hamascha. Sarvar nidanam jagato hamascha. Pacha prabhuvkaschirapada shaktihi. Vacha prabhupkaschirapada shaktihi chitre trilokyam chavilokita cha chitre trilokyam chavilokita cha patap prakasho pyabhavat sa ekaha. Sandy, in the wrong place, we're in verse 3. Sarvaihi nidanam jagataha ahamaha cha vachaha prabhuhu kaschit apara shaktihi chitre atra lokyam cha vilokita cha pataha prakashaha api abhavat saha ekaha. Among the different mats, the different schools of philosophy in India, most of them accept an Ishwara or some type of a god in all of the different schools. So Ramana Maharshi is acknowledging that. What he says is, some god, a god, Prabhu Kaschit, some god, some type of a god, right? Which is aparashaktihi, of limitless capacity. Apara means limitless, aparashaktihi. A god which has limitless capacity, limitless shakti, limitless power, right? Is accepted, is vacha, is told, right? Is mentioned, is told, to be the cause, the nidanam. The very cause, the primary cause of the world and of the jiva. Jagataha means of the jagat is the world. Aham stands for the jiva. So of the world and of the individual. The cause for that is taken to be a lord, some god, a prabhu, a god, who is aparashaktihi, who has all power. So what he's saying here is that, and this is Sarvaihi by everyone, when he says by everyone, means by all of those who are kind of held within the Vedic container, they accept an Ishwara, some sort of a lord. But what is that god? What kind of a god is it? Well, they don't always agree on that, but one thing they agree on, it has to be aparashaktihi. It has to be all-powerful, because it's from that god that the universe comes. Like even in the West, when we think of God, we think of the one who's the creator of the universe, the creator of the creation, the creator of all of the individuals. And so the one who is the creator, whatever type of relationship that you're attributing to the relationship between the creator and the created, the one who is responsible for creating the entire universe has to have a limitless power. Right? Because there's nothing that's going to be outside of that power. You see what I mean? If the whole universe comes from him or her or whatever the sex of the deity is, or the neuter of the deity. So whatever comes from the Lord in that way, if we say that the whole universe comes, then that Lord has to have limitless power. Because otherwise there's going to be something that doesn't come from the Lord. something that the Lord is not the creator of it, who is that going to be? Mm. And so then the Lord doesn't have limitless power, and it's not the creator. There's another creation that has another creator. So when we think of the Lord's terms that are kind of universal, seemingly universal anyway, or common, would be that the Lord is omniscient. These are just Western terms. Omniscient means all knowledge. Omnipotent means all powerful. Transcendent, in one who the creator has to be transcendent of the creator, of the creation, because the creation has to come from the creator. But then also immanent. The creation shouldn't be away from the creator. So most people will say immanent, transcendent. Not that there aren't other philosophies, but I'm just saying the common ones. Immanent, transcendent, omnipotent, omniscient. Here, the only thing that Ramana is addressing is the Parashaktihi. Omnipotent means that the one, that Lord must have all power because of being the Nidanam, being the cause of the creation, the Jagat, everything. And by Jagat in India, when we say Jagat, it's not just the world or all of the planets. The Jagat, the creation, means everything that exists within time and space. Space itself is considered one of the five elements. It's not that the elements exist within space, it's that space itself is one of the elements. So space, air, fire, water, earth are the elements that comprise the entire creation. And within this creation, because there's rajas, because it's in continual motion, there is time, right? Because time is the marking of change. So time and space, and then all of the objects within that, within time and space, are all part of the creation. But they look at it, the easiest way to understand what they mean by Jagat, everything, when we say everything that exists within time and space, what do we mean when we ask you to have an imagination? Like if I ask you to have the meadow imagination, it's not like the space is already there and all the objects come in to fill it, right? Whatever you imagine includes, as its very warp and woof, the space, right? So space is one of the elements. So everything that exists within time and space means everything that exists within duality itself is considered the Jagat. Now, if you say that, that would mean that also existing within the Jagat, in the universe, are things that we consider sentient and insentient, right? Because sentient beings exist within the universe and insentient beings exist within the universe. Insentient beings would be like, you know, the table or the rug or a stone or the clothes that you're wearing. Sentient beings would be anything that reflects consciousness in any way. Like, for instance, a plant has some sentiency. You know, a human being has sentiency. Worms have, insects have sentiency. Animals have sentiency. And from a Hindu perspective, everything that has sentiency is a jiva. In other words, a jiva taking a physical body. So we'd look at this, we'll see why this is important in a minute. If we look at this whole physical world, we can say that the physical world, everything in it is, in a sense, insentient. It is insentient. But some of the things are pervaded by sentiency, just as this one level that I'm doing. Everything is insentient. But some things are pervaded by sentiency. In other words, all of our bodies, these physical bodies, are, from their own standpoint, insentient. If they're dead, right? They're insentient. So the physical material of these bodies does not necessarily reflect consciousness. A dead body doesn't reflect consciousness. And so a body that does reflect consciousness is said to have a subtle body. So a plant, for instance, which enjoys sentiency, what allows it to enjoy sentiency very limited consciousness compared to a physical body, what allows it to enjoy sentiency is what we say is a subtle body. It's being pervaded by a subtle body. A type of soul is not really a good equivalent, but then you can kind of understand it as a soul. Plants have a soul. Human beings have a soul. insects have a soul. Any living creature that has a modicum of sentiency has a soul. What we mean by soul, though, from what we, instead of a word, using a word like soul, which is a Western word and it's not exactly an equivalent, we use the word jiva. You know? A jiva is a transmigrating, conscious, subtle entity which takes body after body after body within this creation based upon their karma. That's all part of the Hindu cosmology. It doesn't really matter whether it's Buddhist or Vedantic or yogic. Doesn't make any difference. This is kind of the Vedic cosmology that is accepted within the whole Vedic culture. And so now, what I'm saying here is that we have a creation, right, which is made of a manifestation, infinite manifestation of names and forms, some of which seem to reflect consciousness, and some of which don't. This doesn't. We would say, this doesn't have a subtle body if I got into it from a Vedantic perspective. This doesn't have a subtle body. This doesn't have a subtle body. I have a subtle body. Okay? Subtle body is that which allows, that enlivens the body with consciousness, with sentiency. Now, that's our experience. We don't have to define it in that way. We don't have to talk about it in that way. But the experience of every individual here is that I, a conscious being, and living in this creation with other conscious beings amidst a lot of things which are insentient. So I don't see this entire creation as a sentient being. I see myself as a sentient being, and I see you as a sentient being. But I don't see the rug as a sentient being. It's not talking to me. It's not reflecting consciousness. Swamiji would say, this chair isn't complaining that I'm sitting on it. And so, if I'm going to think about the creation just based on my sensory experience, you know, I'll say that the creation, the jagat, is inert. It means it itself is not conscious, but it is filled with conscious beings. You see that? I just look at this physical universe, it is inert and filled with conscious beings. You probably would not necessarily say that this whole creation is a conscious being if we're just basing our sense perception on our sense perception. If that is so, if I say, okay, whether I say conscious beings have a soul or not, or I have a jiva, transmigrating jiva or not, I still see conscious beings existing within an insentient universe. If you have that duality right there, then you have a dvaita, a duality that we call the jiva and the jagat. The jiva are the jivas, I'll put it in plural, the jivas are the conscious beings, and the jagat is the insentient world in which the conscious beings live. So this is, I represent a jiva, and this world that I experience represents the jagat. The world that I experience is the jagat. And it'd be the same for each one of you. You are a jiva, and the world that you experience, you know, is what we call the jagat, the universe. I'm a conscious being experiencing the universe. Now, what do we do with God? So there's a jiva, we're jivas, experiencing, conscious beings experiencing the universe. Now, Ishwara, or God, is going to be what? Conscious or unconscious? We would say, we're not going to say God is unconscious. Right? Because that wouldn't be God. Then we have to get rid of God. Then there's just jiva and jagat. We say God, we mean God as a conscious being. Now the question comes, and this is kind of where the problem comes, is God a conscious being different from the jivas and the jagat? Is there a God who is the aparashaktihi, means is all powerful, and has created this universe, the creation, and the creatures? That's kind of Christian terminology. the creation and the creatures, yeah, the Jagat and the Jiva. Is there a God who is a conscious being, who is all-powerful, who has created this universe? To make three. God creates the creation, and then within the creation creates the creatures, the Jivas. So then who is God going to be? Well, God is the creator. And from what vantage point does God create the creation? Swamiji always tells this joke around this. You know, little children are always asking questions, you know. And so this one little boy asks his mom, Mom, where was God? Where was God when he created the world? You know, where was he when he did that? And his mom said, well, he was in heaven, honey. And then so that he asked, well, who created the heaven then? Who created heaven? No, God created heaven. God created heaven. But if God created heaven, where was he before it was created? Right? Then where was he? If he created the earth, he was in heaven. But if he created heaven, because he's created everything after all, if he created the heaven, then where was he? So Swamiji said he must have been in hell. He loves that joke. He must have been in hell. Because where was he? Where was he really? What's his location? You know? Now say, so that's kind of a hard question to answer. Because if you look at the Jagat as the creation, as that which, you know, the whole creation, which means that which is manifest as time, space, and everything in it, including all of the Jivas, and there is Ishvara as a creator, where is Ishvara located? Because he can't be located in time and space. He can't be located in the creation which he creates, right? Because it wasn't there when he created it. And so, and now there's another problem. So God creates the world, creates the space, air, fire, water, earth, and all of duality, which wasn't there before he created it. Then what did God use to create the world? Because none of the tools of creation are there before he creates it. In other words, does he use space or fire or water or wood? What type of earth? What type of elements does he use? And what is he made out of to have any duality, to have any hands and limbs to even do the creation? Because those things haven't been created yet. And so then we think, what does that God look like that is free of the whole manifestation of Maya? Means free of all duality. Where is there even God, a God to make a decision? Let me create the world. Where was he located? And where did he get the mind and the body and the form, you know, to use to create, right? And if you can't answer those questions, which you can't really, because all of those things require a duality, so kind of a subject-object relationship or some material. And so if there is no material, then how can you say that there is a creation or a creator even? Right? If there's no material to create the creation, how can you say there even is a creation in the sense, in the true sense of the word? A creation meaning that this world has been created. You know, like this table has been created. It's been built by a carpenter, and one of my friends, by a carpenter, out of wood. He created this table out of wood. Yeah? And so now, how did God create this creation? Out of what wood? You know, out of what elements? Did he make a decision? You know? And so then the question comes, that's not possible. That's not possible because the creation includes all of the duality. So there's nobody there to make that decision, right? Nor is there any material there to make that decision. And so then you have to say something like, well, actually, the material itself was never created. It has no beginning. Right? Because how could it have a beginning? What would it come from? Do you see what I mean? Like if there is duality and you say that duality has a beginning, what is its prior condition? You can say that everything that exists within this creation goes on changing and changing and changing and changing, but that is material that is changing. That is change that's going on within the Maya, within this creation. So it's changing, changing, changing. But if you take away the material that we call Maya, then what is there to come into being to go on changing? And so, in fact, in India, they will say, in Vedanta, they will say, this Maya is beginningless. It's absolutely beginningless. Because there's no possibility of creating it. There is no one to create it. Within the duality, there's all kinds of creation. There's continual creation. But what is going to create the manifestation of duality? And who is going to create it? Because prior to the manifestation of duality, there is nothing there to create it. There's no duality to create it. So we say this Maya, this manifestation of duality, is itself beginningless. We say it's beginningless and it's cyclical also. It comes into manifestation and goes out of manifestation, comes into manifestation and goes out of manifestation. But they will say this material, as though material that comes into manifestation and goes out of it, manifestation into unmanifest condition, is something which is beginningless because there's no other solution to that problem. But if you say that, that this creation is beginningless, then where does that leave God? You would have to say that God is beginningless too. Or that there is no God. So they will say like this, God is beginningless too. Why would they say that? The only reason you would say that God is beginningless because this creation, this Maya, is beginningless, is because they view this beginningless creation as sentient, as conscious. If that is so, if they look at the whole Maya, this whole creation, as beginningless and as conscious, then one thing comes to light right away. They don't view God as a creator. They view this creation as God. Not God as a creator, but this creation as God. It's a huge difference here. I'll get into the awareness aspect in a moment. If God is this creation, this whole, because this whole is a conscious being, then that's going to shed a different light on certain questions like, why did God do it like this? Why did he make so many mistakes? Why did he create suffering? Why did God create suffering? Actually, why did God create this multiplicity? Why is there inequality? If God is good, why is there so much suffering in the world? Right? So all of these questions, you know, if God is good, if God is all powerful, see, if God is all powerful, this aparashaktihi, then why is there good and evil? See what I mean? Like, God is all powerful. If God is all powerful, why did he create evil? Because if he created evil, then that gets into, you know, a kind of a confusing situation of whether God is good or not. Because when we think of God, we don't think of God as the devil. We have another word for that. You know, for evil. When you think of evil, you think of the devil. When you think of God, you think of good. That's kind of a split that has come along with Christianity. We have the good God and the evil devil. But if you say God is good and God is all-powerful, then why is there evil? These are major theological and philosophical questions. There's a lot of argument about it because they don't have a real answer. The answers are all arguable because the answers all exist within duality. But what about from a Vedantic perspective? A Vedantin will say, God is beginningless. He doesn't have a father. You know? He doesn't have a father and he doesn't have a grandfather. And nobody created God. That means God is. The creation is, God is. This is what God is. If this is what God is, do we say, why did God decide to be like this? Well, when was the decision made? When was the decision made? Because this creation is beginningless. So there's no God deciding to be in this infinite form, because that would require a prior condition. I think I'll create this infinite form in this way. There's no prior condition like that. There is a beginningless creation, which is in this form, which is an infinite form, but it says within the infinite form, there's a structure. But this infinite form, which has structure, space, air, fire, water, earth, you can see it even when you dream. When you dream, there's a structure. Space, air, fire, water, earth, and all the elementals in conjunction, moving about within each other, in and out of each other. There's motion, there's certain laws that are holding it together. Yeah. Now, so that's a dharma, that's the structure of this infinite manifestation. And that infinite manifestation repeats itself in a limited form in terms of your dreams. Right? So that structure is there. And then that structure, this infinite manifestation of the creation, which is considered to be beginningless because otherwise there's no way for it to come into being. Right? Remember that within time and space there can be change and duality, but not outside of it. And so now, what about when we think of God, or even think of yourself, what about the consciousness aspect of the creation, or the consciousness aspect of God? Because we wouldn't consider God to be inert, just like you don't consider yourself to be inert. There's a consciousness quotient here. Now the thing is, everything is a common denominator to this creation. First common denominator is identical with the second common denominator. I would even say the first common denominator is the second common denominator. They're equal. They're one and the same. The first common denominator is that within this entire manifest creation, everything, at every level and in every aspect, exists. And so being itself is the, I would say, non-dual common denominator. Existence itself is the non-dual common denominator. Because everything that you experience, even if it's an imaginal experience, when the experience is there, it has being. It exists. And there are no exceptions. As long as something is there, it is. And the existence, the being of it, is not wavering. Okay. Now the question is, this, I would say, non-dual. Why I say non-dual being is because it's unwavering. Things come and go in being, but the being never comes and goes. In other words, any object, all objects within the creation, come into being and go out of being. Come into existence and go out of existence. Continually. But being itself never wavers. Just think about it. Everything that you experience comes into being and out of being, but the glue, the thing that is the constant, is the being itself. We don't usually think about it like that, but that's the fact. Even when you're, look at this type of a movement. Like when you go from the waking state into the dream state, right? You don't notice, it's absolutely seamless. Your movement from the waking state into the dream state is seamless. Because the radical difference of experience, the exit of the waking state from one's experience and the entry of the dream state into one's experience is seamless, because the being itself hasn't shifted. It's just like this moment right now seamlessly leaves and presents the next moment without a flicker, because the being is the constant. You know, what is, the isness itself is the constant. And so you don't ever experience a gap in being. You experience change coming and going into and out of being of all things that you experience. But there's never a flicker or a gap in the being itself. Now, this being that we're talking about is labeled by you, by each individual, as my amness. You are, it is, and I am. So my amness is the same as that's isness. That isness is my amness, is your arness. See what I mean? If I'm talking about the kind of the common denominator, like say in this room, the being, my being, is taken for granted in this room. But my being isn't the only being that's taken for granted. Being itself is taken for granted. Because I don't say I'm the only one that is in this room. Everything that I experience equally is. Right? Now, that's actually a huge statement. We're working on Ishwara here. We'll get to him in a minute. Everything in this room, my amness and your arness and the object's isness, you know, is really the constant. But nothing that we experience in terms of the names and forms, including this body, this mind, the sense organs, the thoughts in my mind, even the I thought, all of my perceptions, right, have that constancy. None of it. Everything in my experience that I experience through my sense organs or through thoughts in my mind, none of them enjoy a constancy. All of them come into being and out of being. I give my constancy to all of those experiences, because all of those experiences take place in something which is invariable and pervasive to every experience that I have, which is its very content, its very being. Now, that being that I am and that I own as myself is not that which is coming and going, or I'd be gone. Right? Because everything that I experience is coming and going. If that were me, I'm gone. I'm long gone. That isn't me. But what is me is the very being that is the self of all of this, but is not objectifiable as an object. If it was an objectifiable as an object, I would be coming and going, because everything in this creation is coming and going. So what is it about me that is not coming and going? It's simply me, my amness. But this amness has another, I would say, not quality, but it is something more than just amness. The amness that I am is consciousness. It doesn't have the quality of consciousness. It is consciousness. They are two words My amness, the I am, and the consciousness that I am are just two words, amness and consciousness, pointing to my nature. They are two words that are pointing to one non-dual reality, which is me, the conscious being. Consciousness is as pervasive and ubiquitous as amness, you know? Because if I can say everything that I experience is, without exception, on every level, everything that I experience is, even my ignorance is, because it's an experience. That's why we give actually a bhava or being to ignorance. Everything is. But equally, everything, without exception, in my experience, now it's a jiva, haven't moved to Ishvara yet, everything in my experience is known. I can go, it is, 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 it is. I can also go, it is known, it is known, it is known, it is known. I cannot have an experience outside of consciousness. So consciousness is the common denominator. Now everything can, just as everything comes into being and goes out of being, everything comes into consciousness and goes out of consciousness. For myself, as a limited jiva, as one individual within this manifest creation, I have to look at that reality, the reality from the limited upadhi, the limited conditioning adjunct of myself as an individual. And so I can, because I'm not the, this whole creation isn't my infinite mind. I have a limited mind within the creation. Nevertheless, my experience is that there is nothing in my experience, even though everything in my experience comes and goes, there is nothing in my experience that is free from isness and consciousness. Knownness is just another word for consciousness. Right? These things are in my consciousness. Just I'm using regular language. All of this is in my consciousness. All of this is, so just follow me here for a minute, all of this is, and all of this is in my consciousness. What happens is the mind has this dehatma buddhi, or this identification with the body, that is so strong that when we say that, we think, see, all of you are, and all of you are in my consciousness. But actually, the entirety of my experience, which includes what I am perceiving, which includes the physical body, which includes my sense organs, which includes the variants going on in my mind, which even includes the ahankara, which includes all the multi-levels of fluctuating experience, all are taking place equally in my consciousness. So this room is pervaded by my consciousness, and the room includes my body and my mind and my sense organs and all perceptual data equally in my consciousness. So now what if I were to say, okay, the whole thing, including this body, mind, sense organs, is and it is in my consciousness. How far is that painting from my consciousness? How far is the painting? I would say, well, obviously, it's 12 feet. Is the painting 12 feet from my consciousness? The painting is 12 feet from my body. Right? It's not 12 feet from my consciousness. The painting, the intervening space, the body, you know, the sense organs, the moods, the emotions, all equally are in my consciousness. How to get something away from it? Now look at, if I go like this, okay, all of this is in my consciousness. If I move like this, I'm shifting the direction of my mind through my sense organs, this. Now, all of this is in my consciousness. That's right. Whatever I experience, you know, through my sense organs and mind, is pervaded by, is in my consciousness. Nothing is ever, ever away from it. So my being, in fact, is the constant. But now, and the conscious being that I am is not something that I can objectify and look at. Oh, look at that. Isn't that a cute little consciousness there? Or look at that being over there. I can say that, but then I mean I'm talking about the chair. I'm not talking about the being, about existence itself. So my being is, and it is stable, but it's the very substratum, the very self, the very pervading all of this Maya, not objectified as an object in it. Now look at the situation. See, for you, you can see in reference to this room the pervasion, or the pervasion of the me, the conscious me that you are. But it's harder to take it all the way out to the universe, the entire universe. I can't say that I, the one who am experiencing this world through my mind and my sense organs, is the same as Ishwara. Okay? So this conscious being that I am must be limited by my mind and my sense organs. Say no. Your mind and your sense organs are limited. The body is limited, the mind is limited, the sense organs are limited, because they are parts, they exist within an infinite creation, right? And they're limited, they're subject to birth and death. But what is the limitation of consciousness? Because you, the being, the existent being, is not an object within this creation. So how are you limited by it? Like, this body is an object in the creation, and so it is limited by other bodies, and it's limited by space. Consciousness is not an object. Being itself, consciousness, which is conscious, is not an object in the creation. So how is it limited by it? We say it's not any more limited by this creation than the relationship that conscious being that you are has with your imagination. When you imagine a meadow, is consciousness, the conscious being which the meadow enjoys, is the consciousness limited or touched by the meadow? And if you imagine a meadow, do you become limited by the meadow? You say the meadow enjoys my consciousness, but is the consciousness limited by the meadow? If the meadow comes or goes, does consciousness care? See what I mean? Just think of this. I ask you to imagine a meadow. Okay, you imagine the meadow. Now the meadow's there. And then I say, okay, let's move on. Just get rid of the meadow. Now the meadow's gone. Meadow comes, meadow goes. What is the effect on consciousness? Has consciousness become the meadow, and then consciousness, the meadow is gotten rid of, and consciousness dies? What happens to consciousness when the meadow comes and the meadow goes? It's like nothing. When the meadow is there, then the meadow is. When the meadow is gone, then just isness is. When the I am, and then I am with the meadow. The meadow is gone, and then I still am. Okay? So nothing happens. That's why when you go to sleep at night and you have a dream and you wake up from the dream, you know, the dream was and the dream is gone. What happened to you? Absolutely nothing. Absolutely nothing. In fact, this is such a good, I would say, exercise, is to notice when you wake up from a dream, you can actually say, that dream is gone and yet nothing has happened. The dream has come and gone, and nothing has happened. It is in fact totally irrelevant to your being. Nothing at all has happened. The dream did not contribute to your being, nor did it take away from your being. So nothing has happened because the being is stable, it's untouched. Now, when we use the meadow imagination, the characters within the meadow have a different experience. They have the same experience and a different experience. The same experience for a character within the meadow, or you and I within this room, the sameness of the experience is that there is never any experience that takes place that is away from being, the being in consciousness, which is yourself. That's true as well for you, as well as much for you as a character in the meadow as for the one imagining the meadow. The entire meadow is in my imagination. Then there is nothing that takes place within the entire meadow that is away from being consciousness. If you're an individual within the meadow, there is no experience within that you have within the meadow that is away from being in consciousness. The being consciousness is what is actually there. Whether your the experience is from the standpoint of a jiva, from the standpoint of the jiva within the creation, and so the experiences are limited, still those limited experiences enjoy the same reality, the sat-chit, as the entire meadow enjoys, the conscious being that the entire meadow enjoys. And so here, in this level of reality, in this waking state, it is exactly the same thing. The being and the being conscious being that you are never is away from any experience that you have. It is the solid, changeless substratum of all experience. For Ishvara, the whole manifest creation, exactly the same thing. There is nothing from that vantage point that is away from sat-chit. It's just from the standpoint of Ishvara, the Maya Upadi, the infinite Maya Upadi, the infinite manifestation that we call the Jagat, the creation, is like an infinite mind compared to your limited mind. An infinite mind means there is nothing, the sattva of the sattva, rajas, and tamas, that reflecting capacity of the Maya, is unhindered by any individual upadi, any individual mind or sense organs. And so the experience of the entire creation, right, is Ishvara. The experience of the individuals within the creation are the jivas. But what is exactly the same is me. The me experience is not different at all. Tibby needs something, maybe. That's okay. The experience, let's see if she really needs something.
Yeah.
No, she doesn't.
Actually, I don't think she does, Peter.
No.
You can check that.
She needs to get to the door.
Oh, I see. So when we talk about Ishvara, perhaps you can say, maybe you can say that from Ishvara's standpoint, there is nothing in this infinite experience that is away from or other than me. As a jiva within Ishvara, within the total Maya Upadi, I would say there is nothing in my experience that is away from me. Ishvara would say there is nothing in my experience that is away from me. The me is exactly the same. There's only one me. It's just the me, right? From the standpoint of Maya, is the self of a limited experience or that same one self of an infinite experience. So just like I can say, if I have a dream, I am the self of the dream. I'm Ishvara. I am the Ishvara of the dream. But the characters in the dream can say, you know, I am the awareful being of this experience, this limited experience. I am the awareful being of this limited experience. That one who's saying I am the awareful being of this limited experience is referring to the same, the awareful being, which is the awareful being of the infinite experience. And so the consciousness, the self of Ishvara, which is the self of you, is not something which is bound by time and space. And so for Ishvara's self, we don't say that, you know, the Brahman, the self, the conscious being that you are, the conscious being that Ishvara is, has been, you know, going on for a long time. There is no long time. There is no time. There is just me, the present that I am right now. The me that I am right now is the me that has always been. It's the presence that has always been. There is no always been. There is only now. There's only now. And you have never experienced ever anything but now. Your memories are now. Your projections are now. There is only now, because the conscious being that you are has nothing to do with time and space. Time and space belongs to, you know, this creation that we call creation. It's not really a creation. You know, it's an infinite manifestation, you know, of Maya, which has no beginning and really has no end. And from the standpoint of the total Maya, and that Maya has for its reality a changeless self, because no time in consciousness. That being so, this Maya, which has for its being or for its substance a changeless self, where is there really any jiva jagat ishwara? See what I mean? Where's the jiva jagat ishwara? The individual, the universe, and ishwara. We would say, no. There really is only Ishwara. But if we say, no, there really is only Ishwara, then the problem is, well, what is Ishwara really? And then we say, well, Ishwara is really only Brahman. It means Ishwara is really only consciousness. Because all of this Maya is itself coming in and out of consciousness. It has no substance or being of its own. And so just like for you, who are you? Are you the experiences that are coming and going? Are you the conscious being in whom these experiences are coming and going? If you say, oh no, I'm the one that's coming and going. No, that one's gone. You're the one who is here. And the one who is here has not gone. Right? There's no time for you. There's time for everything that takes place within duality. And that you is Brahman, is the self of Ishwara. Right? You can say, is the self of Ishwara? Does Ishwara have a self? That means there's Ishwara and a self that it has, like a self existing in Ishwara? Or is Ishwara the self? So we say, really, Ishwara is Brahman. It's like saying, if I say that Ishwara is Brahman, that's like saying the pot is the clay. The pot is clay. Ishwara is Brahman. What it means is there's really nothing here but Brahman, nothing here but conscious being. And so here in this verse, so it starts out with, you know, everyone says there is a Lord who is limitless. This is said by all of the different Vedas, all of the different methods, the different schools within the kind of Vedic traditions. They all accept an Ishwara, okay? A Lord for the Jagat, for this world. There is a creator, there is a Lord for this world and for for the individual. What does it really mean, though? So Ramana says like this. Here, this is like the drishtanta. Chitre atra. Atra means here, in this painting. Look at this whole universe as a painting. So he says, here, there is lokyam, all of the things that are being perceived, all of the objects that we see. And there is vilokita. So just imagine, you know, a painting. Here are all kinds of objects on the painting. And then we see all kinds of people who are looking at those objects and interacting with the objects. So we see all of these things that we see, and we see the seers also. So imagine a painting, and the painter comes and, you know, paints the sky, you know, paints the trees and paints the pathway, and then puts some animals in it, and then puts some humans in it. So now we have some subjects, some knowers, vilokita, people who are seeing, and things that they're looking at. And then also, there's the cloth, because the cloth had to be painted on, right? So there's the canvas. So if we really look at this painting, we've got a canvas, and we have objects, and we have people looking at it. And then also we have the prakasha. We have, you know, that which allows the painting to be seen. He says the prakasha. So that actually all of the seer and the seeing and the seen and the canvas itself, all of these things, you know, make up the painting. So this is a drishtanta. It's an illustration that Ramana uses. And in the end he says, and all of this whole painting is just only one thing. How he's using the illustration, if any illustration has some limitations, but what he's saying is, you know, there is one canvas. There's one substance here, the canvas. And on this canvas, all of this duality appears. The seer and the seen and the whole picture, you know, the whole scene with people in it who are looking at objects, and the seer, the seeing, the consciousness which is involved in the seer has to be able to see the object, so whatever allows for that scene, all of that is here. But really, substance-wise, there's only one canvas. So that's his vision. You can another a vision that you can use that is kind of similar, that if you're looking at a movie screen, you know, there's the screen and all of the colors, but there's only one light. That's the reality of the whole thing. Here, he's using this illustration just to say that canvas is Brahman. The canvas is Brahman. All that you see here, all of this picture, the seer and the seeing, the subject and object, are nothing but one Brahman alone. You know? That Ishwara, when we say Jiva Jagat Ishwara, you know, as he'll say in the next verse, this Jiva Jagat Ishwara, no such thing. What causes that duality of Jiva Jagat Ishwara is what he says is the ahammatihi. The ahammati means the ahankara. Once you say, I am this, right? Then there's me, the jiva, this world that I experienced, the jagat, and the Lord out there somewhere who created it, right? Because I've identified my being, my consciousness, the conscious being, as being here in this body, different from the rug, different from the space, different from the chair, and different from you. And so we have sentient and insentient, right? And the Lord has to be somebody, a sentient being, who has created all of this. But once that ahankara is removed, you remove the ahankara, then there's just one conscious being, which is the self of this whole thing. And so now with this root verse is really the first verse of the Saddarshana. Now he has to go on, he's going to go on and explain this more. But this, he considers, you know, the commentator here considers these first two verses, I said this last week, as prayer verses. This is Ramana's first verse, you know, of this text. And so now he has to work on it. And it's a big, very big verse. Let's stop here. Purnamada Purnamidam Purnat Purnamudachate Purnasya Purnamadaya Purnameva Vasishate Om Shanti 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 Hari Om Shri Gurupyo Namaha Hari Om.
Thank you.
I take it that this question must in some way make the most sense. But can you tell me why it doesn't make any sense?
Yeah.
Does Ishwara have self-knowledge?
Ishwara has self-knowledge in the sense that there's no ignorance. Mm-hmm. You know? So think of it like this. If we think of consciousness as changeless, free of time, and then what we call this Maya that manifests as this creation, we'll say that the Maya itself has two shaktis, two powers. One is avarana, means the power to cover, and the other is vikshepa, the power to project. So these two, it's important for understanding Ishwara. For Ishwara, the one who has the whole Maya, the projection of the whole Maya, there's no avarana, there's no covering. Like, for instance, if you imagine, not like deep in dream, you go into ajnanam, into total ignorance, really, and from there the dream comes. And so when you're in dream, you are just another jiva within the dream. But if you use imagination, if you imagine a meadow or imagine a scene, the entire scene comes from you, is sustained by you, resolves into you, and that's knowledge. That there's no ajnanam there. You know that as a fact. You know that the dream is your being, and that you, the dream is you. You and you are free of it. Right? So that knowledge is there. But for a character within the dream, or within the imagination, that knowledge isn't there. And so what is the mind and sense organs that are limited within the imagination are subject to avarana, to covering, which Ishwara is not subject to. And so the knowledge is limitless because there's no ajnanam, there's no blocking, there's nothing to block it. There's nothing to block the knownness on any level. Right, because the whole thing is a manifestation of knowledge. Whereas that's not true for jivas within the manifestation. The blocking is beginningless. It's not like they become ignorant. It's like the situation itself is the cause for that ignorance. You see what I mean? And so to say it's in a sense, does Ishwara have self-knowledge? Ishwara is all knowledge. You see what I mean? Because there's no ajnanam anywhere. Ajnanam means ignorance.
Yeah.
Yeah.
So you're saying that he does?
Well, you're looking at, in a way, there's a little bit of a problem with the question. The problem is that the question is anthropomorphic.
Yeah.
Right? Because for you, that's a valid question, because you could not have knowledge. Does he have knowledge, you know? Has he gained knowledge? That type of thing. Like, do you have knowledge or do you not have knowledge? I could ask you that. But for the one who is the manifestation of knowledge, there's no prior condition to having knowledge or not having knowledge.
Okay.
There's no duality. Mm-hmm. You know? You see that? I mean, there's not even any duality, because there's nothing that is not me. Mm-hmm. Unless you, it's like if I say I'm walking along with my shadow, there's no duality there. There's no separate entity for there to be two of us. You know, so the manifestation of this creation is not something that is separate from me for there to be two of us. Nor is there any chit-chat going on. Do you know what I mean? There's just infinite expression. There's chit-chat and relationship and subject-object and all of this within the manifestation, but not for the one who is the manifestation, who is the very self of the manifestation, of the infinite knowledge. Do you see what I mean?
I think it's a related question about the meaning of ignorance.
Mm.
I've been thinking lately that ignorance, the meaning of ignorance is basically limitation. The limitation of knowledge. As an example, in Panchadashi, he's saying the tenth man is stuck on nine. You know, like that nine is the limitation of the tenth man's knowledge until he comes to know I am the tenth man. And so that covering, otherwise, if we don't think of ignorance as limitation, if we think of covering sort of in dualistic terms, we think of it as a thing. There's a thing that's covering.
Yeah, like a cloth or something.
Versus just the limits of the limitation almost of the vritti.
Well, that's true. I would say more like this, though. I think that's right. You're on the right track anyway. For Jiva, the knowledge that you gain is dependent upon a means of knowledge. That's why in Vedantin and in Indian philosophy itself, the understanding of the different means of knowledge that you have available to you is so important, because the means of knowledge are what create what we call a jnana vritti, a vritti, a thought modification that is true to the object, right? And so as long as my eyes are working and, you know, and I don't have astigmatism, I can look up and see the moon and not see two moons. I see one moon, and I'm seeing the moon that you're seeing, so we have a shared knowledge, and that's because I have a means of knowledge that has the capacity to see that. And I have the ears that have capacity to hear that, to hear whatever I'm hearing, as long as they're working well. But say, in this situation, the self is, and it is self-evident, self-evident consciousness, and it is the very substance of all means of knowledge and all objects of knowledge. But there is no means of knowledge available to me to give me a vritti which is true to the nature of that knowledge, mm-hmm. right? That's why the Upanishads say, I am a means of knowledge, mm-hmm. in order to direct your mind to the recognition, you know, of yourself. Because all of your means of knowledge only direct out here and outside, and so there's nothing to give you that vritti.
Right. My question was really one about the level of Ishwar, you know, and why from the standpoint of the Jiva, there is a jnanam versus from Ishwar's standpoint. And I don't mean knowledge about the self, but of the creation.
Right, it's because of the limitations of the mind and sense organs.
And so on that level, ignorance is just limitation. Is that correct?
Yes, well, you can say it that way, because you're limited by your means of knowledge for the type and the limited mind for the type of vrittis that you can have. So it's like you're shining a light, you know, your little tiny light in the creation to be gaining vritti after vritti after vritti, which can be removing, continually removing ignorance. Mm-hmm. You know, as you gain a vritti based upon a real means of knowledge.
Limited by the range of the...
You're absolutely limited by... That's right. We say, like, all the sense organs and all your means of knowledge that you have available to you have what we call epistemological limits. They can only go so far, you know? And so some things are out of their range, right? And if they're out of your range, then you don't have a way of knowing them. You can speculate and fantasize and make things up, but you actually don't have a means of knowledge to know them.
How is the self outside their range?
It's outside of the range in terms of not the experience. This is why the whole question of experience and knowledge becomes so meaningful. You can have what they call just a general knowledge, where they call it samanya jnanam, where all of us can say, I am, I exist. You know, and those words are referring to my being, or I am a conscious being, you can say that. But that's only a general knowledge. You can't say that, if I ask you, yes, you are a conscious being, all of us can say that, we're all in agreement. But then once I push it a little bit, like, is your consciousness, does it survive the body? Is the consciousness which I enjoy separate and distinct from the consciousness that you enjoy? Right? What about the consciousness that God enjoys, if there is a God? So this is what they call visheshajnanam, particular knowledge, and these particulars aren't known. Right? And so that's problematic. We use for an example of that is like the rope snake example, like if two boys are walking along at dusk and one mistakes a rope for a snake, there still is a samanya jnanam, a general knowledge there, which they see that thing there that has, you know, the bends in a certain length and a certain diameter. They see the thing, but they don't see what the thing is, you know. To say in the tenth man's story, the tenth man is certainly having the experience of himself, you know, but not that this experience person here is the tenth man. So that's the difference. There's a samanya jnanam, this general knowledge, but there's not the specific knowledge. But here I have the self-knowledge of myself as a conscious being, but I don't know that I'm Brahman. Mm. You know, and that my consciousness is free from time and is the self of the entire creation. Mm. But the very self which I am and my very self experience, once I have self knowledge, I recognize this very me, the very self experience that I've taken to be the body, is the very me which is the self of the whole creation. So it's in terms of self-knowledge, it's not about the gain of your self-experience. That's already there. It's about taking away from that self-experience the limitations that I had placed on it. Through, not I had placed on it, really. It's that it has been placed from beginningless time on until I gain knowledge. Because ignorance itself is beginningless. When did ignorance begin? What's its prior condition? Not knowledge. I don't know what to do about this computer. It's on its last legs.
You know, when you were talking about Ishvara being the material of the entire cosmos, everything.
Yeah.
I was thinking of, you know, in like that sometimes they have holy objects like in the church and they use them for sacred events. It seems to me that knowing this, that you would see the world as a sacred object of some type.
Well, let me say something here and then I'll get, I have a way to answer that I like. Online people, you know, I lost you for a moment and now we're back. Hopefully you can hear me. But any little messages that you put up there, and I saw a couple of questions, they're gone now. So you have to put them back on. Put them back on if you want me to answer them. You know, even for a person who doesn't have self-knowledge, who is what we call like a saint, or a person that has a high degree of vairagya, where you're not asking the world to be different. When you're taking a walk through nature, for instance, when you're on your surfboard, you know, you recognize the sanctity of the world. You don't have to be a jnani to recognize the sanctity of the world. And you know, we have so many experiences of that.
Yeah.
It's just that they can be fleeting, because what happens is that the world is also complicated and my relationship with it is complicated and I have all of these needs and all of these fears and doubts, you know, that complicate it. And so that always comes like a tidal wave over me and takes away from these periods of recognition of the sanctity of the world. Even when I don't have Vedanta or I don't know that this whole thing is Ishvara, I still have a sense of its, you know, of its sanctity. It's like being in a temple.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. But when you have knowledge, your mind starts to really understand the whole thing, so that the things that cause you to lose that recognition,
mm-hmm.
those moments of loss of that recognition of the sanctity of the world or the nature of Ishvara, or like you're walking through, you know, Ishvara.
Mm-hmm.
You know, as the mind kind of matures in this knowledge, you work out the Pratibandhikas, the different, you know, obstructions that we have and complexes and all these things that we have, that sense of sanctity goes on increasing because your mind is less and causing less and less problems for you. I mean, the problem, you know, I mean, our mind has had a hard time, not just this life. It's been here for beginningless, so we're really old. You know, and we've had so many experiences, and in this life itself, we've had so many that, you know, lifetimes of conditioning, and this life, this pain and that pain, and this thing went wrong and that thing went wrong.
This very disaster.
Very complex. You know, and so for the mind to unravel all of that and then just be able to enjoy your knowledge. See, the mind's capacity to enjoy your knowledge goes on increasing. But way before that, you notice that your mind is maturing, and you also notice that you can hold this mind as it's maturing. Doesn't mean you don't have knowledge. It means that your mind isn't matured in this area or that area. It still has this problem and that problem. You know, it's like taking care of an unhappy child. If you have a little child, your child's unhappy. You have to help that child, you know. If your child's learning how to walk, you have to help it. You know, it's going to keep falling down and falling down, and then you pick it up and pick it up and pick it up, and then at some point it's just taking off. That's what it's doing. Our mind's kind of like that. You know, and it's not something you can really, really rush. It takes a lot of patience, you know, and a lot of love, a lot of kindness, you know, to give your mind time to mature. Just think of this is only one little life, and we think, you know, spending, you know, several years in terms of gaining knowledge and letting the mind, you know, unravel all that it has to unravel. You know, as though if I were really, really a good person, you know, if I was really cool, this would all happen in a few months or a month or a year or 2 years or 3 years. But I'm so slow. You know, it's taking me 10, 20 years. But then I forget that it's beginningless lifetimes that I'm unraveling.
Mm. You know? Is that true? I mean, you really mean that when you say that?
I really mean it. I really mean it. What I would say is that, you know, your knowledge becomes that jnana nishtha, and that takes place way before your mind really matures into your knowledge. But that process of maturing after, you know, a period of time is very enjoyable, because you have enough vairagya not to be beating on your poor mind. You know, you're just helpful. Just like you're helpful to other people, you're helpful to your own mind also, and you're patient, because you don't put false expectations on it. It goes on learning and working out its things in the light of your knowledge. That's the difference. There comes a time when your experience, including the experience of your mind and your emotions and all of this, you know, are all taking place in the light of your knowledge. But prior to that, there's your moods and experiences and complexes and things seem to overwhelm your knowledge. And so there's just kind of a gentle transition that takes place there, where at first you're getting overwhelmed and then you're not. And then the mind is just, you know, has its own time. And you can enjoy it. You can enjoy that. Once your knowledge isn't overwhelmed by your mind, then you can take care of your mind, and you're not afraid of it anymore. So that's the kind of the joy of maturing.
Because you have to have the proper expectations about yourself in this.
That's
also.
Right.
Yeah.
That's horrible bummer to have these ideas of how it's supposed to be, and when that's not the way it is, then that's also another very confusing thing. You know, we have all of these all of these ideas that stop you from really kind of enjoying a very, actually very beautiful process that takes place over time. The flowering of the mind into the really the more and more enjoyment of your knowledge. But your knowledge and your what do I mean by knowledge? Now, I'm not talking about intellectual knowledge, there's the intellectual understanding also, but I'm saying your own, the recognition of your own presence, your own changeless presence. You know, that self which is Brahman, which is Ishwara. The recognition of that and nishtha in that recognition means rootedness in that recognition. The mind still has emotional lag time, even after the rootedness in that recognition. But then, there's a nishtha in that recognition, then this mind that is still working things out is working things out in your knowledge. See what I mean? It's like you, the buddhi, who has knowledge, and who is not, the buddhi is no longer can be overwhelmed by the emotions of the mind. Then that buddhi, which has knowledge, takes care of this mind as you would take care of, you take care of your friends, you take care of your partner, you take care of your children, you take care of your animals, you take care of your employers, employees, you know. So we do, we help. We do what we can in the situation, just everybody does, naturally, I mean. And you do that for your own mind also, because it has this problem and this worry and that problem. You know? And it matures in time and settles down in the light of your knowledge. You can't expect that to be like an overnight occurrence. There's too many samskaras, there's too many hurts and complexes and worries and, you know, things we've picked up along the way. It takes time. Like Swami uses the example, don't take a beautiful little rosebud, you know, and try to tear it open. Love your little rosebud, and give it water, give it satsang, you know, give it teaching, give it, you know, being in the company of people that you yourself, you know, that are on the same path as you in terms of your values and what you want, give the type of person you want to be, give it that type of company.
So we don't have to be a psychologist to help our mind. I mean, it just this.
Well, you know, I actually think that we do give a lot of psychology in Vedanta, sort of, you know, Swamiji, like this inner child work and kind of understanding how to be with the inside as well as the outside. Vedanta gives it in a very limited way. You know, it's not that it's not there. It's there in very seed form. But we have to give more because we have more problems.
But anybody that's studying Vedanta would have and be qualified to treat their own self, their own mind.
If they know how.
I mean, yeah. You don't have to go to university and become a psychiatrist or anything.
No, not at all. Yeah. He's saying you don't have to be a psychiatrist to treat yourself, no. Yeah. I think you get plenty here. No, really, seriously.
But you know, it's nice to have that confidence. I mean, that's an important.
I have a value for therapy, but I don't think that you have to go to a therapist. I certainly don't see anything wrong with going to a therapist. I think it'd be really helpful if that's what you feel to do. You know, there's nothing negative there. Mm-hmm. But there's a relationship that whether you go to a therapist or not, there's still a relationship with your mind and with your emotional self, with your hurt parts that you need to know. And if you know that, the mind can transform and change. And I don't think, without that, I just don't know how that happens. I think a lot of I just think that's so curative to the mind and all of the parts of the deep parts of the psyche, is that if you know how to be with it, to care for it and to love it like you would love a child, your child, you know, that you have that type of caring relationship, you know, that allows the mind to change.
Yeah, when you said a couple of weeks ago about notice the difference between loving your mind,
yeah,
and liking your mind.
Love, like, and respect.
and respect. There's definitely a difference. But I have a hard time respecting the meanness of the mind. The meanness.
When the mind is being.
Yeah, mean. The agitational part, you know? I find it hard to stay with that and go like, no, I like you and I respect you. Yeah, but rip your head off. You know what I mean? It's kind of a. But that's what one is to do, right? That's what one embraces.
When, you know, I think when you see a part of yourself that is small or petty or mean, you have to go a little deeper to see who the person is, you know, who it is that's, what's behind the feeling. You know, you have to go to what's behind the feeling. That's what I think. You have to understand what's going on with that person.
But sometimes there's such an overwhelm and such a charge, there's no way to get behind that.
Sometimes there isn't, but then you can wait and you can get behind it later. Because that overwhelm will always die down. It won't outlast you.
That's true.
Yeah. And so when it dies down, then you can go, you know, and talk to that part. You know, once it's over, gone down, then you can.
Well, yeah, then it gets clear. Then it tells you exactly why I did it, and what I did. In the meantime, it's pretty painful not to get for it to simmer down. You know.
Yeah, but that's why. True, but that's why I love that exercising of breathing in. Because say when it's really out of control, say you're really in a dark space. You know, then the tendency of the mind is to really react against, you know, like to push it or fight it or get mad at it. But instead what you can do is just breathe it in. Because when you breathe, when you do that act of breathing it in, there is nobody pushing away.
Yeah.
You know, there's no subject object there.
Yeah, the breathing is not trying to change it. The breathing is trying to really.
There's no resistance. When you breathe in, there's no resistance at all. There's just containment. Mm. And then it's easy to bring out, to breathe out some peace. And then you can do it again and breathe out. And so that exercise, which I think is this Buddhist exercise, actually, I think it's such a beautiful and very powerful exercise. You know, it's a technique. It's just, these are techniques or ways of. It's in your toolkit of ways of dealing with the mind and the areas where it's been really, really hurt and can have just really painful, deep, dark reactions. So when those are there, you have to be able to bring in some of these. And sometimes it requires, you know, talking to somebody. That's also something to know. You have to know when to talk to somebody.
Mm-hmm.
You don't have to do everything yourself, you know. You can talk to somebody. Talk to the right person.
Yeah.
That was funny.
I've done that.